Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of March, Monday at 9, is All Things Political. And our guest this hour is Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. We're going to be talking about AIG bonuses, the banks, CNBC versus Jon Stewart, Michael Steele, and a number of other topics this hour. What's in the news politically? Welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Or you can send an email this morning, and that number is talk@WPR.org. Michael Steele, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Morning, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Let's start with AIG paying $450 million of bonuses, our money, to employees of the unit responsible for the New York insurer's near collapse last fall. People are a little outraged this morning.
Yeah, it's especially bad timing, you know, as people sit down to finish working on their taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Year, to see where all that money has been shoveled out the door to. You know, politicians here, it doesn't take long for them to figure out an easy target. And, you know, you've already seen just this morning, since that news broke, a handful of people, Barney Frank was saying on the Today Show this morning that this amounts to rewarding incompetence. So, you know, it seems unlikely that Washington will sit back and just let that stand.
So what will they do?
Well, that's a little unclear. The White House, seems to think they can find a way to get some of that money back through, you know, the ongoing negotiations they have over how to get money out to stabilize AIG and some of these other companies. So I guess we'll see. You know, the president said several times, though, that he hoped sort of a culture of shame, you know, and just calling companies out would stop them from doing things like this. And that obviously didn't happen here. So, you know, I wonder if they'll have to rethink their plans for preventing this sort of misconduct in the future.
I know that Feingold has been active in his comments against all of this, too, and is asking if Congress can figure out some way to get that money back, the bonus money back. Can they, do you think?
They may or may not be able to. I mean, you know, I'm not all that familiar with exactly what kind of contracts AIG had with the people that they paid the money to. I don't believe there's a provision in the existing law from the first bailout, you know, the one that was passed last fall, that allows them to do that. But I think, you know, they could certainly, if AIG comes back and says it needs more money, which does seem sort of likely considering the trouble they've been having, you know, you could envision a scenario where the government says, well, you can't get any more unless you get some of this money back, or, you know, we're withholding X amount in order to pay for the bonuses, something like that.
Mm-hmm. The Times had a piece this morning saying that the Obama administration is increasingly concerned, and I'm not sure what form this would take, about a populist backlash against banks and Wall Street, worried that anger at financial institutions could also end up being directed at Congress and the White House and could complicate Obama's agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that people who've been working on these bailout issues have been chewing on for a little while. You know, Democrats in particular tend to sort of sound a little anguished and conflicted about the fact that they feel that this is the best policy, that, you know, continuing to prop up these banks. You know, you can't talk to a Democrat in Congress who is working on the financial issues now without them reminding you, gee, you know, all this stuff came up under the Bush administration, and, you know, the reason there were so few rules is because the administration didn't want to do them. And so I think, you know, they may share some of that anger, but I think they're also particularly concerned that, I mean, if you look at the polling, that the bailout is just resoundingly panned. I mean, even the few people who supported it back in October among the public don't seem to like it much anymore now. So it's something to be nervous about, certainly.
I was watching Bernanke on 60 Minutes last night, and he was expressing his great displeasure with AIG as well, but said that it was simply something that had to be done. He was comparing it to a house fire, somebody who was smoking in bed and the house burned down. And what do? You got to save that house because otherwise it's going to burn down the house next door. I'm wondering if this could mean that we're closer to some kind of a collapse of the system if we don't keep carrying on with this, if we don't figure out some way to make AIG viable and yet make them also morally responsible.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that you still don't see a whole lot of people who are in a position to do anything about it talking about nationalizing, even temporarily, some mm-hmm. of these institutions. You know, and you would think that if you're concerned, if you're a member of Congress or you're in the White House and you're concerned that voters are getting fed up with these bailouts, you would think maybe that might be a solution you'd want to talk about. But, of course, talking about nationalizing banks before you actually do it can sometimes make the problem worse because, you know, we saw what happened with some of the bank stocks a few weeks ago when Chris Dodd sort of didn't quite rule out the possibility of nationalizing banks. I mean, you know, they all sort of plunged even faster than they had been. So it can become a self-fulfilling policy prophecy, but you know that does seem to be there. It does seem like that's coming sometime down the pike. You know, some of these banks may actually be insolvent once they start putting the stress tests to them that the administration is planning to administer, you know that could be the only way out, other than just continuing to fork over more money to them.
You wrote a piece last week saying some kind of bank nationalization is probably inevitable. The Democrats don't want to admit it yet. The Republicans just want you to be scared.
Right. Well, bank nationalization is one. It's. I mean, it sounds scary. And you know, the idea of the government's going to seize the banks. You know, I don't think anyone's talking about the type of nationalization that you often read about in the international section of your newspaper, where the government literally just walks in and seizes all the assets of the bank. I mean, this would be nationalization in order to split off the toxic assets from the valuable ones. And theoretically, at least, it would be brief, and you know, they would get everything back into private hands at some point. But no one seems to know what all those sort of mortgage-backed and other esoteric odd financial instruments are worth anymore, and they need to get them kind of out of the system in order for banks to feel comfortable with their balance sheets. And you know, whether even if it's just sort of putting them all together into a bad bank sort of thing, which you read about often, you know, people seem to think that that's going to require the government to actually take over some of these institutions, even just temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
But the politics of it are dicey because you know, Republicans have decided that calling President Obama a socialist is one of their best lines of attack right now. So, you know, the administration doesn't want, while being accused of socialism, to sort of idly muse about bank takeovers if it doesn't feel like it actually has to do it.
Do you have a better understanding now? You wrote this piece about 6 days ago. The stress test that the Treasury Department is going to be administering to see if banks are viable or not. You talk about the fact that many will probably prove to be insolvent, which will force this issue. What are those stress tests? Do we know yet?
You know, I don't know yet. You know, you would like to think that the Treasury knows yet.
Yeah, you would.
But they haven't told me. But, you know, the theory, I think, is to sort of look at, you know, look at pricing some of these assets in ways that are a little bit more realistic than the way the banks may want to be treating them. You know, there's a lot of people out there who think that basically if these things are actually worthless, they take up such a large percentage of what's on the balance sheets at a lot of these institutions that they then won't have, you know, once you factor that price in, they won't have enough capital on hand to meet regulations about how much money you've got to have if you're a bank, which is, you know, believed to be part of the reason that lending has slowed down so much, is because all the banks sort of know that that a lot of their assets are tied up in these securities that are now more or less worthless. So, you know, I think that's part of what they're going to look at, is sort of, you know, okay, if we price these like this, you know, if we can get this price for these assets, then this is what they would turn out to be. But, you know, they're promising some more details about some of that stuff over the next handful of days, so mm-hmm. hopefully we'll all know a little more soon.
And what about the president's role in all of this? He's been criticized by some as not being as involved as he needs to be, that he's given management of this whole crisis to Summers and Geithner, and they were part of the problem before. So we need something really quite different here, and he's not front and center.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Geithner doesn't have a whole lot of people working for him yet at Treasury, so I think Treasury is under a lot of strain because there aren't many people in some of those senior posts besides Geithner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the administration tried to have Geithner go out and sell their initial take on financial stabilization last month, and it didn't really go very well. And then the next time that anyone from the administration started talking about it, it was Obama, it was the president. And you know, today he's appearing with Geithner again. So I think they're trying to walk a line between having the president be out there in front of everything, but also making sure that, you know, he is their most effective salesman for their policies. So making sure that when they need to, he can push for them. You know, when they appointed Summers and Geithner during the transition, a lot of aides said that was part of what they liked about them, was that they were part of the system. They sort of knew the players, knew how everything worked, could help put things together in a more reasonable fashion, would be sort of reassuring to Wall Street and to the entire system. So, you know, so far there's no reason to believe that they've dramatically changed their mind from that, despite the criticism. I mean, you know, this is not an administration that tends to be plagued by a crisis of self-doubt.
Right.
So far, at least. So, you know, I guess maybe they feel that what they're doing is working.
Yeah. And why is it that Geithner doesn't have many people working with him yet, Mike? Nobody wants to apply, or jobs
too
hard?
They've had several appointees sort of crash out of the vetting process. They've had problems getting people all the way through the confirmation steps. You know, and apparently sometimes they run into these little tax problems, like the ones that did not derail Geithner's nomination,
right.
But you know, there's also very complicated conflict of interest rules if you're going into the Treasury. So I think it's just it's a complicated and difficult process, and I think you know that they're finding that it's especially, you know, maybe now with the economy the way it is, it's difficult to get people to come in from the private sector and make it through all these checks and balances before they can get themselves into the post.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines are all filled. We'll move into other political topics as well that Mike has written about in the last few days. Mike Madden is our guest for All Things Political, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com, and start with Mary from Manitowoc. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have so appreciated all the programs on public radio to help somebody like me to understand what's going on and know how complicated it all is. I'm so glad your speaker is on today, because I've been wondering for the last couple of days, why are these people getting the bonuses still in their jobs? Because if somebody lower down the food chain had messed up that badly, they'd be gone.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You tend to think of bonuses as being, at some basic level, profit sharing. So when a bank loses billions of dollars the way AIG did, you almost would expect the executives to be writing checks to the bank and not the other way around. I don't know why they're still in their jobs. It's becoming increasingly clear that the financial world is an even more confusing and complicated and weird place than the political world, which is the one that I know more about. I have no particularly good explanation for it. The government can't really force them to be fired, or at least they haven't pushed to force them out. That might be that maybe AIG feels that they've done the best they could under difficult economic circumstances.
Well, somebody should start asking that question, who's giving away the money.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's right. I think Congress probably ought to start asking that question.
Don't you think they will this week? I have a feeling that a few might be not having their, maybe losing their jobs by the end of the week. I don't know.
You would think. I mean, especially if it comes down to, you know, you're going to have to change the way you're handling your personnel and your compensation, or else you're not getting any more money next time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Mary, thanks very much for the call. And it's hard to contrast all of that. I'm somewhat fixated on this because it's such a change in America. Not that there haven't been homeless people, but this new class of people who are living in tent cities in various parts of the country because they used to sell cars, you know, they used to be involved in, they used to have homes, they don't have homes, they don't have cars. And as one of the people said this morning who was being interviewed, we don't have anything to go back to. We don't have a job, we don't have a house.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to feel sorry for anyone who's in the financial industry who's complaining about their bonuses not being as large as they were. And they have had the poor wisdom to complain about that, you know. But it's remarkable. I mean, you know, the people that suffered the most from the financial collapse are like on a completely different planet from the people that are still with these companies.
Right. Let's go to Katie from Milwaukee. Hi, Katie.
Hi there, folks. Thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
I wonder, are there not some provisions from the savings and loan scandals back in the 80s or even further back from other economic problems we've had in this country that would allow for more transparency in these companies that we're investing in as a nation, and also opportunities for clawback perhaps through some provisions even within the states in regards to previous economic conditions that we've already had to create laws to deal with?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know a whole lot about the laws governing you know, the S&L bailouts and how they differ from this one. I know that this bailout package that passed in October had very little in the way of teeth attached to it. I mean, it was basically just the administration has the authority to hand the money out however it would like to. The administration is reportedly planning to put out some new transparency and regulatory measures soon, and you know, they already introduced their proposal for future bailouts where, you know, they would limit executive compensation as part of that and would hope to sort of rein in some of the excesses. But I think it's difficult to go back retroactively and impose conditions on money that the Bush administration had already given out. That it seems like the companies would probably fight that pretty aggressively.
Mm. And what is the role, thanks very much, Katie, for the call, of the Republicans in helping to fashion a solution to this, in being a loyal opposition to the plans that have already been presented? I know you wrote a really interesting piece about Michael Steele, who's kind of out there on his own in many ways.
He's sort of becoming the loyal opposition within the loyal opposition. The Republicans are taking different approaches depending on whether in the House and the Senate. In the Senate, you know, they still have, due to the institution's rules, they still have quite a bit of say in how legislation is written. I think they're taking a more active role in at least attempting to participate in the legislative process. But in the House, John Boehner was quoted last week saying, I was at a lunch with reporters not too long before that, where he said something similar. He basically said he's telling his members not to think of themselves as legislators, that they're basically just communicators, because the minority under the House rules has no particular power or clout, and he doesn't want House Republicans thinking that they have to come up with ways to improve the Democratic ideas. He just wants them to come up with ways to talk about why their ideas make more sense. So, they're sort of effectively in opposition without much program except to oppose in the House so far.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Steele, you know, presents an he's got his own problems, but I think Republicans are still trying to figure out how to respond to the new political environment here. They're not really sure what to make of Obama's popularity and sort of for falling back in a lot of ways on some of the same arguments and ideas that they were using the last two cycles.
They could use a strong chair. You write in your piece about Michael Steele recently that he's probably in there to stay for a while, isn't he?
Yeah, I think it became sort of a popular topic here in Washington to speculate about his future, but it's actually more difficult than people imagine to force him out of the job. I mean, the rules make it difficult because they need a two-thirds vote to do it, but also just the situation would be there. I mean, you know, he was just recently appointed and elected by the members, and you know, it would look pretty dismal for them if they suddenly realized, gee, this was a terrible mistake, and they went back and tried to do it again. But also just the optics of it would be bad. I mean, you know, here the party was very proud of having elected its first black chairman, and you know, if he were to be forced out and replaced by another middle-aged white guy, which is most of who's in politics in either party, you know, that would sort of undo a lot of the efforts to show that they were diversifying that the party was very proud about.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike from Appleton next. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning.
Hello.
I'm an avid student of all things political and economic, and I'm terrified because I really don't think anybody really has a clue as to what's going on.
Mm.
And what worries me, and I think the Obama administration has a huge problem, and that's confidence. Okay, I'm a micro businessman. I have the possibility of hiring, you know, a couple of people. And there are millions like me. And with zero confidence in our politicians and, you know, the people in charge of Treasury, I mean, you know, we look at this gentleman Geithner, I mean, you know, with his tax problems, that's astonishing. Yeah, they may want to say that it was a very complicated thing, but it isn't, because I've gone through the same thing myself. So, you know, zero confidence. I hear, you know, just I really don't think they know what they're doing. I don't think anybody knows what's going on. So am I going to go out and hire people, which is what the country needs desperately? Because the important number here isn't, you know, isn't the stock market. The important number is the unemployment rate, and it just keeps shooting up and up and up. So, you know, I don't know.
Well, what could they do that would make you more confident?
Well, you know, they say, okay, when Obama comes out and talks, that's supposed to give us confidence. But, you know, I question that, because I say, well, you know, is Obama a businessman? Has he ever had to meet a payroll? Does he have a clue as to what that, you know, what's involved in something like that? In making real, everyday, little business decisions that are important? No, he hasn't. And probably the majority of them haven't. So how am I supposed to have confidence of people who haven't been in the trenches, so to speak, and who are mishandling this? You know, I mean, every time Geithner goes out and talks, the stock market goes down.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to appear reassuring and competent and also confident. But then they're also trying to put some more rules in place so that people have some basic confidence that the system isn't going to melt down like this again. And you know, it sounds like they're not doing as good a job as they probably need to be in explaining some of those rules and really getting that stuff out there. But, you know, remember, again, it's only been 8 weeks that the administration's been in office, and I think they are finding that they sort of are making, you know, making decisions as they roll along. You know, it's not as if they had a big, you know, ready-to-go plan in place for fixing the entire system. So, you know, I guess you may just sort of have to wait and see if they reassure you anymore as they start putting out more details.
I mean, it is true that almost everybody's, it's a fairly general statement, but a lot of people just aren't spending any money at all. Even people who have some, they're worried they might lose their jobs. They're saving their money. They're not stimulating the economy. And I think that Mike is right, that nobody has a clear indication of what caused this, how complicated it is, and what exactly needs to be done and how large it needs to be to make things better.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's difficult. What caused it is actually a little easier to figure out than how you solve it. You know, I think we don't know. I mean, it's one of those situations where I don't think you can look at things and say, well, here are the three steps that need to be and will be taken, and then all of a sudden things will be fixed. I mean, it seems like the problem is much more complicated and more difficult than that, and it's possible that some of what they're trying won't work. You know, and that is unsettling. I agree.
Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8648. 855. We go to Ralph from Green Bay next. Hello, Ralph.
Yes, good morning. I think it all boils down to really easy money. For the last half a dozen years, anybody that was renting could have bought a house for less than their rent. So nobody was going to turn down that kind of a deal. They could always go back to renting again. You got credit card offers daily in the mail. I could get $10,000 with no interest for 12 months. And, you can't do that if you're a business without at some point going broke. And now the government is doing the same thing in that they're giving this money, no strings attached. We just got to get away from the easy money, easy lending kind of thing, and get back to basics.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you certainly hear stories that indicate that the banks have gotten away from easy lending. I mean, now the problem may, if anything, have the pendulum may have swung too far in the opposite direction. Apparently, it's some banks are demanding down payments of 30 or 40% for mortgages in some areas. And, I think the interest rates are still relatively low, but it's much more difficult to qualify for a loan, and probably that's in the long run for the good, but, makes recovery a little bit difficult right now. But it's true. I mean, that seems to have been the main problem of the last few years is everyone just sort of expected things would keep booming forever, and then when they didn't, the consequences were worse than anyone had expected.
And I guess just I wanted to add one thing, if I could.
Oh, yeah.
The government is still doing that. They're the ones that are giving the easy money right now. And I think they got to get a little tougher too.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right, and I think that touches on what we were talking about before with the anger at the bailouts. Unfortunately, there's just not a whole lot of strength in the government's hand while they're still distributing this first chunk of bailout money because it wasn't put into the system. So there's sort of it's easy money still for the corporations. We can sort of hope and assume that it'll be a little bit more regulated in the future, but you're right, for now it's still easy money.
The other thing that you got to wonder about, it seems as though everybody needs to take a few classes in what's the right thing to do. These people who are getting these bonuses, we've mentioned this before, but you wonder, I've had a lot of conversations with people about how you can sleep at night, knowing that there are people in tent cities, knowing people are losing their jobs, that major industries are going under, that all kinds of people are feeling this incredible angst about the economy, and you're getting an over $1 million bonus in your company mishandled money in a huge way before this? It just, where is a sense of morality?
I agree. I mean, it's hard to imagine how any of those recipients could feel that they deserved the money.
Right.
I guess in an ideal world, then they would just hand the bonuses back of their own volition. But I think
right. We'll see that tomorrow, won't we?
Yeah, right. They'll just fly over on their pigs.
Yeah. All right, Ralph, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Mary from Janesville. Hi, Mary.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a quick question. It's going to drag us back into the incredibly complicated world of banking. But recently I've been hearing about goodwill write-offs. I have researched that in every way I could think of, and I'm just looking for some kind of a cogent explanation of exactly what that is. I've seen a bank here in Wisconsin who did goodwill write-offs, and it lowered their losses for the quarter significantly. Could you tell me what that means? I just really don't understand it.
I'm afraid I can't. Unfortunately, I'm a political writer more than I am a financial writer. Although I guess
you're becoming a financial writer now.
Yeah, these days the worlds are converging. But
right.
I don't know what that means. There's pretty complicated accounting rules in terms of how corporations have to account for what they've got on the books. And, you know, I could try to Google something and come up with some kind of jargon-sounding explanation that might sound like it makes sense, but I have a feeling I wouldn't actually know what I was talking about. So,
where did you...
That's exactly what happened yesterday. I sat down and just Googled and came up with a number of websites, and all of them had very detailed, extremely multi-syllabic explanations that were industry terminology that was just almost impossible for someone like me, who is a neophyte in banking, to have any kind of an idea what it really meant.
Yeah, I mean, I think it may be that it doesn't really matter what it means in terms of, you know, a layperson's understanding. I guess it's, you know, so long as we understand that companies are taking some sort of charge on their accounts to account for it, you know, I mean, it doesn't seem like it's something you need to understand very carefully in order to know, you know, how to balance your own checkbook or anything like that.
I mean, it does have something to do with the solvency of the bank, and that's what concerns me.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, but I don't think that I'm in a great position to assess the solvency of the banks either. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, to some extent, we may unfortunately still be in the hands of the experts with some of those calculations, even though the experts helped get us into this situation.
And they're in the process of examining the solvency of the banks, right? That's what we were talking about earlier.
And I guess, you know, to the extent that goodwill has anything to do with, you know, the public image of a company, it's hard to imagine that the banks have much left. So, you know, I don't know how they'll take that into account in examining these banks. But you know, the financial press, I would imagine, would have fairly detailed explanations of some of those decisions as they're made in the next few months. So, you know, keep your eye on some of
them. Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Our number, 800-486-8655. And let's go to Ken from Milton next. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hello, Ken.
I've been sitting here chomping at the bit because Secretary Bernanke explained why AIG has to be bailed out again and why these bonuses have to be paid particularly. They have to be paid, he started with, this is a government of laws, and these people have got contracts, and the government just cannot come up and dissolve these employment contracts that these people have. And these people have got contracts that say, you know, if we lose money, we're going to get bonuses. Just imagine what they'd get if they made money, you know? But that's the reason we are a government of laws, and this is why those bonuses have to be paid. And Bernanke said that traversed the whole country looking for the best banking lawyers that this country has, and the government has to pay those bonuses under the laws we have now.
Yeah, well, the bank have to pay the bonuses. I don't know if the government pays them directly, but no, that's true. I mean, you know, if people sign these contracts and they're entitled to these bonuses, then there's not much you can do to break them, although, you know, you would hope that some of them would realize the situation that they're causing for the bank.
Well, you would have thought, though, because it's our money. I mean, we're involved in giving them the money, so you would have thought that with the government bailout of this, there would have been restrictions on how our money is being spent. And of course, we would vote by probably 99% of us would say, don't think we're going to give million-dollar bonuses. We have to change the rules here.
Well, that's what's so frustrating about these bailouts for the banks is that, you know, when they were first put in place, there were no restrictions that came along with them, and they really can only restrict them going forward. I mean, you can't, you know, I guess you could sort of through political force of will basically declare those contracts null and void, but I think that would not necessarily be good for the stabilization of the banking system if suddenly people felt that the government was going to run around retroactively and go through contracts that were already on the books. I mean, apparently that's actually one of the problems with why they haven't moved to nationalize some of the banks is because they're not sure what that would mean for all these intricate trade contracts that they have and some of the negotiated agreements with other banks, and they're sort of trying to figure out how they can unravel those without just severing them immediately. But yeah, you, I mean, you would think, and you would certainly hope that going forward they would make it impossible for these bonuses to be paid out like this.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655, the number. And Mike Madden is our guest, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike Madden is our guest, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. And we'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. There's so much going on. It's unbelievable, isn't it? The new head of the FDA, we want to talk about that. Former New York City Health Commissioner Margaret Hamburg, the president talking about how extraordinarily important this issue is. We had a lot of important issues, but because of the economy, it's on the sidelines here a little bit. There's a lot to be done in this area. We forget about tainted food and tainted peanuts, and that whole system, people are saying, needs to be overhauled, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that you've heard more and more people saying that in the last few years, and I think that's, you know, a large part of why the concept of eating locally and eating sustainably has gotten more and more popular with people is because, you know, it may cost a little bit more than just running down to the supermarket to buy whatever is on hand, but it you sort of know a little bit more about where your food's coming from, and it's less likely to wind up getting pulled into one of these salmonella outbreaks or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's been a long time since the food regulatory system was sort of carefully scrutinized. So it does seem like it's well overdue for an overhaul.
Mm-hmm. And the word in Washington is this is a pretty good appointment.
People seem to be pretty pleased with it, yeah. You know, it hasn't gotten as much buzz as some of the appointments, you know, slightly higher rank appointments, or frankly, as much buzz as some of the bigger, you know, the financial or even the fate of Michael Steele. I mean, the FDA is one of those agencies that if you're not kind of a policy expert in it, you know, it's not necessarily political consultants don't sit around talking about how to fix the FDA, unfortunately.
Right.
Although, you know, maybe if people paid more attention to it, then it wouldn't need to be overhauled. But, yeah, you know, the announcement was greeted with praise pretty much. So,
well, it seems to me to be a fairly important thing, and it will become front and center as soon as there's another incident, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, you know, the FDA in that way is sort of like FEMA was before Katrina, where, you know, you sort of people didn't pay huge amounts of attention to it until something went wrong. You know, that's probably part of what needs to change. I mean, you need to have people thinking about drug safety and food safety well before people start getting sick from eating products that the agency has allegedly said were okay.
Let's talk about the press and the financial meltdown as well. I'm sure that you've seen parts of it. I just saw it last night on video. This Jim Cramer being on the Jon Stewart show, and Jon Stewart really lashing out at CNBC. What about that? I'm sure you've seen it or heard about it. And what about this role of CNBC? It's kind of a strange role for a network to go crazy with all of this, isn't it?
It is. At CNBC, you know, I was reading in some of the reports over the weekend that some people from the network were unhappy with Cramer because he basically didn't make any effort at all to defend the network. You know, he went on there with Jon Stewart and kind of folded completely not only his own position but also, you know, punted on any attempt to defend the network. I mean, you know, they have kind of a weird hybrid of pretty good financial reporting and pretty bizarre, overheated talk shows. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have people doing reports through the day, and then all of a sudden you have Jim Cramer on throwing cows through his legs and shrieking about, you know, quick stock picks. And you know, I was actually talking last night with some people, at dinner about, you know, you wonder how long that model's going to work, because if the economy remains the way it is, it's hard to imagine that there's going to be a huge audience for someone just saying, buy this stock, sell that stock, without explaining why. You know, it seemed like the popularity of CNBC was tied so heavily to the performance of the market, where, you know, if it was kind of, you couldn't help but make money and everything was going up, then sure, you'd tune in and watch the coverage. It's sort of like, you know, if your sports team is doing well, you're likelier to look at the highlights that night on TV.
Sure.
I mean, that got a lot of talk here in Washington, the Jon Stewart, Jim Cramer showdown. And you know, you wonder if Cramer wouldn't have been better off just not taking the bait the first time Stewart started bashing him,
mm-hmm.
Rather than turning it into a running feud.
Right.
Because it didn't end well for him.
Yeah. Let's go to Neil from Boscobel. Hi, Neil.
Hello, how are you doing today?
All right.
I am very curious about how much money, after listening to This American Life and their explanation of the financial meltdown, which I don't think made Wisconsin. I was driving back from Chicago. They tied a lot of money, like way beyond the world's gross product, to the credit default stock swaps, or whatever it's called. And I wonder how much of our money, starting from the Shearson and Lehman, which started this whole liquidity crisis, went towards these default swaps. And like, as, and I keep hearing about derivative products and this kind of soundbite, but nobody ever mentions that about these things. And what they seem to be is insurance policies that were never funded or regulated. And, I mean, it started with Clinton dropped the ball on the regulation, and he passed it on to the Bush administration, which obviously didn't regulate anything. And then here we are now, and it's like billions and billions of dollars for each one of these derivatives, and nobody talks about it, and what is going to happen with it. And so when they say too big to fail, my understanding is because if they do fail, billions of dollars that nobody has to be paid out for these various mutual fund credit default swaps. Do you know anything about that? And why is this so under the radar?
That's a very good question. And I know a little bit about it. I can try to answer it. The credit default swaps, my understanding is that they are yet another component of the toxic assets that are in the system, because they were, you're right, they were initially insurance. The theory was if you had a bond in a company and you were worried that they wouldn't be around to pay you back when the bond came due, you could buy this thing called a credit default swap, and it would basically be insurance against your position in the bond. But at some point in the last however many years, some of the financial institutions realized that they could make as much, if not more, money selling and trading the default swaps than they could actually investing in companies. And they sort of took on a life of their own, and there was no limit on the number of policies, basically, that could be written on any one bond. So, you know, it's almost as if you went out and bought, 40 or 50 different expensive life insurance policies on yourself, something like that. Then people would buy and sell these swaps with almost no regard for the fact that they were actually supposed to be rooted in some level in the performance of an actual company. And I think they were wrapped up they were turned into securities. You'd sort of wrap a bunch of them together and sell them and trade them. I mean, the outer fringes of the financial world seems to consist mostly of companies buying and selling these bizarre instruments that mostly existed just so that they could sell them back and forth between each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that the administration claims that it wants to try to start regulating, and you know, that they want to give the government some authority to step into some of these derivatives and regulate them in a way that they haven't been up till now. But I think you're exactly right. That's a big part of the problem, is that these things are out there and they would come due if these banks started failing, and there's billions of dollars sitting in them.
This gets so complicated.
It does.
Ugh.
It does. And, you know, again, you sort of look back and you say, how did anyone come up with this stuff, and how did it get to be where You know, it just seemed like it was a good idea to start selling these things that had nothing to do with anything actually going on in the real economy.
Exactly. There's a good question. Right. Yeah. Thanks, Neil, for the call. Let's go to a couple emails here. If the U.S. is controlling big banks and AIG, does it mean that taxpayers will ever see a check when these companies get their act together, or will these paybacks find their way to a big government slush fund? Do we know?
Well, I guess, you know, it sort of depends on how you define government slush fund. Anything that gets paid back into the government is, you could call it part of a government slush fund. I mean, that's sort of how taxpayers get their money back, is it gets paid back to the government, and then the government decides what to do with it. But, you know, theoretically, if these things work out and these companies return to profitability and they're able to repay the loans that the government's made, then yes, they're supposed to be paying dividends on the loan, and they're supposed to pay them back in full, and at least in theory, the government's supposed to get its money back and then some. But I'm not sure I would put a whole lot of faith in the possibility of that actually happening across the board the way it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm. And another one, if small businesses are the ones that create most of the employment and are an integral part of a healthy economy, why are most of the stimulus funds going to the largest businesses?
Well, that, I know that, you know, the people who wrote and are distributing the stimulus money would probably disagree with that. You know, the bailout funds are certainly going to the largest businesses and the big banks, although some of them are also going to small, you know, community institutions. But the theory behind the stimulus, the economic stimulus package, was supposed to be that it would kind of get out and just stimulate the economy across the board, which theoretically would be good for small businesses and also for large businesses. The White House today is doing an event on small businesses with Geithner and Obama. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're both appearing at. So I think, you know, the White House is also concerned that, you know, they don't want people to think that the small businessman is being left out. The small businessman and woman is being left out of all this. But yeah, I mean, it does seem like, you know, the way to really make money in business these days is to get a bunch of people together and declare yourself a bank and then just get some government money. But
right. Let's go next to Harold from Rice Lake. Hello, Harold.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Earlier you were talking about those contracts that the banks had with their million-dollar bonus contracts, and you said that they really couldn't do anything about them. But when they were talking about giving money to the auto companies to help bail them out, the first thing that everyone agreed on is that the union people had to take a cut in wages and benefits. So I think we got a double standard here.
I think that's true. I certainly would not disagree with you that it's a lot easier to make it in America if you are a wealthy Wall Street banker than it is if you are a union these days. You know, you've got a lot more power and a lot more financial wherewithal and also a lot more political clout. And I think that's exactly right, that there's a double standard. And I don't have much hope that that'll change dramatically. I mean, you know, this administration is friendlier towards unions than the previous one, but I think you've hit upon a problem that mm-hmm. is probably here to stay for a while.
Thanks for the call. Chris from Glendale. Hi.
I just wanted to add a historical note. In the late 1980s, there was an employee working inside a business periodical. This was a weekly or biweekly newspaper targeted to the business community and the financial community. This man disliked the low-quality journalism that he saw at his periodical. He saw cheerleading, self-satisfied content, a pro-business bias, blandness, and here's what he did. He quietly established a fake name and began submitting letters and guest commentaries that were quite similar to the general thrust of the periodical itself. And he did this secretly for quite a while, and the letters and guest commentaries were published. He even commented on that 1987 market correction and said things like, well, we shouldn't overreact, and everybody should take a deep breath. This was not discovered for quite a while, and his submissions, his guest commentaries, his letters, were actually a slight parody of the kind of lousy journalism that he saw around him. Eventually, he went public, and he published in great detail, in chronological
Baffler, right?
order, everything he did, and he published it in a periodical called The Baffler.
Right.
And The Baffler was Chicago-based. I'm not sure if it still exists.
Okay, we had 5 seconds. Mike?
I've read that piece. It's actually very entertaining. I don't think The Baffler still publishes. Thomas Frank, who was its editor, actually lives here in Washington now, and writes for The Wall Street Journal, ironically enough.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike, so much for being with us. It's amazing how much of what you have to report on now concerns the economy, right?
It's true. Yeah. Looking back, maybe I should have taken more economics classes.
There is still time, sir.
Yes,
yeah, go back to college or read a lot of books on it. Mike Madden was our guest this hour, Washington correspondent for Salon.com for all things political. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program, to Rob Schroeder for doing on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.